You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, what's going on in the brain when a memory forms? And is there anything you can do to stop that? After all, there are some things you just as soon not have etched permanently into your brain. There may be memories of events or people or places. There are also memories of associations. And we have learned patterns associated with these events. Like you might know of someone who has been in combat, for instance, who experiences a moment of panic each time he or she hears a car backfire. There's that memory association, right? The brain has remembered this traumatic event and associated it with a loud sound. Well, writing this week in the journal Science, a group of researchers in Canada, the group says that they have been able to selectively erase that kind of fearful memory association, erase it at least in laboratory mice. Now, as I say, these were genetically engineered for this experiment, so this exact process won't be able to be used in people, but it helps teach scientists about the brain and what's going on inside it in memory and learning. Joining me now is Steve Kushner. He's a visiting scientist at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto and one of the authors of the paper. He joins us by phone from the hospital. Welcome, Dr. Kushner.
Thanks, Ira. It's nice to be on the show.
You're welcome. You say you've been able to erase the fear memories in mice. Tell us what you mean by that.
So memory is not a unitary phenomenon, and this has been known for a long time. For any given experience that you have, there's a number of different memories that are formed. For example, let's say you won the lottery. Mm-hmm. You form a memory of where you are when you found out that you won the lottery, but you also form a separate emotional memory of the joy that must be associated with that. And what we're dealing with, what we're talking about, are emotional memories, in this case, for the emotion of fear.
Mm-hmm. So we all remember where we were when 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination was, something like that. Are those kinds of memories?
Exactly. So take that example. Most of us remember exactly where we were when we watched TV or heard about 9/11. And there's a memory of the experience of that happening. But then there's also an associated emotional memory of being very afraid on that day, which so many of us were.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at the association between the memory of the experience and the memory of the emotion of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were able to do in this situation was to disconnect those and to permanently disrupt and erase the memory of fear that animals had when they were exposed to an aversive situation.
Mm-hmm. So while they were given the stimulus again, the associated fear did not happen.
That's exactly right.
Give us an example of what you're talking about.
So in the situation that we were looking at, we use a very old and very well-described form of learning in which tones, just simple auditory tones, are associated with mild foot shocks that are given to the animals.
Mm-hmm.
And in just one single time, the animals now will come to have a fearful response, changes in their heart rate, changes in their behavior that show us that they're now become afraid just of the tone.
That sounds like that old Pavlov association.
That's exactly Pavlov. It's exactly Pavlov. So
mm-hmm.
Pavlov looked at the dogs, and Pavlov was using conditioning between a bell, which is very similar in our case to the tone, and
right.
its association with food, which was given to the dogs, which would lead them to salivate.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, the bell itself would lead the dogs to salivate. In our case, we're looking at the negative emotion of fear and the ability for a tone to
mm-hmm.
develop the aversive quality that existed when the foot shocks were given.
And how were you able to disconnect those two?
So we were able to disconnect them because the real advance here was that we identified the role of a gene that had long been known to be involved in memory, a transcription factor that acts at the level of DNA to transcribe other genes, the genes called CREB, which seems to have a particular function within the lateral amygdala and possibly other brain regions for selecting those particular neurons that are going to participate in encoding a memory. See, it's long been known that when you have an experience, not every neuron in the brain changes. In fact, it's very sparsely encoded, And so it had long been a mystery. How do you find those small number of neurons in the brain that are actually changing? And this is what we were able to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you physically have to insert something into their brains or cut something out?
So we used a viral-mediated technique in order to transfect those neurons to make it more likely that a subset of the particular neurons in the lateral amygdala were going to be the ones selected during the memory. However, we were able to use genetic techniques, which, as you said earlier, wouldn't be possible in humans, in order to be able to selectively kill just those small subset of neurons without disrupting the function of the entire rest of the brain. That selectivity has never been demonstrated before.
Mm-hmm. That's quite interesting. You know, we've talked with people who are experts in addiction, let's say like drug addiction or other mm-hmm. kinds of addictions, and they say that there are these pathways that are created in the brain that prevent people from not being addicted. In other words, a stimulus comes, they think they've licked the addiction, but then a stimulus comes and they're back off the wagon again.
That's right. That's a very good question. That's a great question.
Is it possible for you to extinguish those also?
So I just want to make sure just we're careful in terms of the specific terms that we're using.
Yes.
Extinction is a term that's well used in the learning literature and refers to a new learning that teaches us to inhibit our responses.
Mm-hmm.
So the standard of care for PTSD, this post-traumatic stress disorder, the standard of care for addiction are methods, psychotherapy methods, which can be very effective to teach people to inhibit their previous responses. However, the original memory is always there, and that's why, for example, as you suggest, in addiction, relapse is so likely. That's why people who have had addictions have to avoid for the rest of their lives the substances that caused them to become addicted in the first place, because the original memory is still there. What we've done is very different. We've gotten to the network that formed the original memory, and we were able to disrupt that original memory, which is very different than the available methodologies today, and what makes us so excited that it may be possible to develop treatments for soldiers who are coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, so I guess what I'm asking is, can you use the same treatment to try to get rid of addiction?
I think that's very possible. That's very possible. In our particular study, we looked at fear memories. But mm-hmm. I can assure you that other people are going to start to look at the same mechanism in addiction. And I can already tell you that there's a wealth of data that the specific gene we looked at, CREB, is very important for memories for addiction. That's already been demonstrated. And it wouldn't surprise me that in other brain regions, this fundamental mechanism of selection of neurons is going on mm-hmm. as well.
Talking with Dr. Stephen Kushner about memories and trying to talk about his experimental successes with the mice, and that's where I'd like to aim this now. If how can you take what, you know, you say we can't do the same things in people because it's just not done. Intervention into the brain is just not done in humans, and we all understand that. But what can you learn that can be
yes.
moved to the human side?
It's a very good question, and it's really, that is one of our principal long-term goals, is to try to be able to translate these results to help patients who are suffering from what I would call maladaptive memories. Memories that are formed in such an extreme form that it causes them dysfunction, which is what happens in post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do the equivalent kinds of genetic experiments that we did in mice and humans, and for good reason. But what we can do is we've now localized to a very, very high resolution the particular neurons that are changing during a learning event. And if we can identify the specific genes and the biochemical pathways that are happening in the immediate aftermath of a traumatic event, it may be possible to design drugs to reduce the likelihood that the memory of an experience is associated with a very extreme aversive fear. And the way that I could imagine that that would take form is that after a trauma, say after a terrible, unfortunate car accident, in the emergency room setting, this drug could be given to disconnect the memory of the experience with the memory of the emotion.
How do you know that a specific memory in your experiments is actually removed?
From mice, of course, we can't talk with them, right?
Right.
So we can't ask them if they're afraid. But fear has a very highly evolutionarily conserved panoply of symptoms. Autonomic symptoms, changes in heart rate, changes in blood pressure, changes in the behavior of the animal. If you've ever seen a mouse out in the wild, if it gets near a predator, a cat, it will do what's called freezing. It will completely stop moving except for respiration. And we can measure those different things in the laboratory as an index of the level of fear. It's one of the reasons that fear is so tractable as an experimental method.
1-800-998-2-5-5. Let's see if we can get a call or two in here. Bill from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill.
Hi. A few months ago, Radiolab had a show on this topic, and I thought it was researchers at McGill University had actually been able to eliminate memory with protein synthesis inhibitors. But in that case, it was all memory of an event in a traumatic situation. Is that the difference between these two groups of work?
Yeah.
That yours is specific and theirs was total?
Thanks, Bill. That's also a really great question. I'm very familiar with that group. And what they're doing is also very, very important and a different way to get at this question. The way that they're doing it is also highly specific for a particular experience. So in that regard, it's very similar to what we're doing. The difference is mainly the time course and what biochemical pathways are being tapped into. But their approach is very similar to ours in terms of the goal, but we're taking very different approaches.
Talking about memory this hour with Dr. Stephen Kushner on Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if I can get one more quick call in here before we bring Flora in. Leo in Massachusetts. Hi, Leo.
How you doing? My question is of a moral nature. I guess the question is, are we putting people at risk for losing the ability to deal with fear, to evolve as individuals, if we're creating the opportunity for those memories to be erased or eliminated? Doesn't that also absolve perhaps political leaders of responsibility if they can just soldiers can come home and then have the traumatic aspects of combat removed as well?
Great. That's a great question, and I'm glad that was asked. Let me say a couple things about that. First of all, we are not attempting, or do we believe that we are erasing the memory of the experience. What we are doing is reducing people's, or in this case, we're reducing mice, their maladaptive fears, and our goal would be only to target treatment to reduce the dysfunction, and it's very severe for some soldiers. I've met many soldiers who have very severe disruptions of their ability to function day to day. We would not want to erase people's memory of experiences, and I don't think that this approach would be able to be used in a way that would, as you suggest, absolve politicians of whatever's going on in terms of their decisions. Mm-hmm. That is not the goal.
And what's your next step here?
Our next step is really, as you suggested, to try to understand the biochemical pathways that are happening in the immediate aftermath of a trauma, to try to identify the targets in order to develop drug treatments for patients who are having these kinds of disorders, as well as to further explore the fundamental biology of how memories are formed. Memories are the quintessential form of how we see ourselves as people.
Dr. Kushner, thank you, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Stephen Kushner is a visiting scientist at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto.